Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. During the summer recess, Disrespect brings you a retrospective interview. If you missed it, this is your chance to catch up. And if you enjoyed it, this is your chance to hear it again. Disrespect welcomes Valerie Terazek, a professor of nutritional sciences from the University of Toronto. And we're going to talk about nutrition, fixed incomes, and the special diet. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You had some very well-formed opinions from your own exposure to data about the nutrition of people on fixed incomes, and your knowledge of what it's like trying to meet people's nutritional needs through a regulated benefit like the fixed diet. Maybe you want to kick off with your point of view, and we'll see where it takes us.
Okay. Well, I guess I'd like to start by talking about Ontario Works, because that's income support program of last resort, right? The publicly funded income support program of last resort, with all kinds of controls put on it to determine who's eligible and make sure that nobody receives Ontario Works who isn't eligible. But it's supposed to be what we do to provide basic levels of income to people who, for a variety of reasons, are unable to access the labor market or unable to compete in what has turned out to be a very, very competitive market. And so the welfare benefits in the mid-90s, this became totally the purview of the provinces, and so they're set provincially, they're managed provincially, and in Ontario what we've seen is a steady decline in the purchasing power of the incomes for people on Ontario Works over the last 15 years.
Yeah.
And so over that period, we've done, and others have done, a number of studies where they've looked at the food access issues associated with low income. Mm-hmm. And invariably, people on Ontario Works surface as being extraordinarily vulnerable to problems of insufficient food access, inadequate food access, meaning that they're unable to buy the food that they need.
Right.
If we look at dietary intakes, we get the same kind of picture. We've got income levels on Ontario Works that are set at levels that are simply too low for people to manage.
Yeah, too low for, you know, pay their rent or feed the kids, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And what kind of allowance, I haven't even checked, I should have checked before I did the interview, what kind of allowance does someone with, say, diabetes get to manage their illness on top of their regular food budget?
Well, they'd have to first be kind of certified by someone. And then whatever their base allowance is, whether it's on Ontario Works or Ontario Disability Support Programs, they'd have some increment on top of that. Now, what the exact number is right now, I don't know. Is it $60? Is it $100? I think the cap on these allowances is $250, but I don't think diabetes is anywhere close to that.
No, I would bet the allowance for diabetes is in the double digits, probably.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Well into the double digits.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But the problem with this special diet system, it's a program that's been in place, I think, for quite a while in Ontario, and as you obviously know, it's one that's under review right now. But the idea is that there are some people with medical conditions that require them to have, that cause them to have extraordinary nutritional needs. Yeah. And so the special diet allowance is a program intended to pick up those extra costs. But the problem with the special diet allowance is that it's a program that's layered on top of welfare payments that are absolutely inadequate.
Yeah.
So it makes no sense. I mean, absolutely, there are people with medical conditions that cause them to have needs for special nutritional products that are above and beyond the cost of normal food. But welfare incomes don't enable somebody to have a basic healthy diet.
So the whatever portion of the special diet that can be accessed by somebody on welfare, a large part of it gets co-opted just supplying a normal diet.
It could get co-opted paying the rent. I mean,
yeah,
the most egregious situation is the income level in Ontario for someone who's classed as a single employable. Welfare and disability payments vary depending on household size and composition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true everywhere in Canada. And it's also true that the worst off in these welfare programs are people who are single. But someone who's classed as single and employable, so on Ontario Works and a single person, right now I believe in Toronto they receive $585 a month.
Yeah.
Now,
food, recreation, transportation, rent, and any over-the-counter
ridiculous.
Medical needs.
Absolutely ridiculous. So if that person is diabetic and they're able to get someone to fill in the paperwork and that paperwork is accepted for them to access a special diet allowance,
mm-hmm.
then they have some small increment on top of $585.
Yeah.
But the money doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, $585 isn't even a rent figure in Toronto.
No.
Everything.
It's not even a rent figure in Toronto. So we're setting people up in a ridiculous situation. So a lot of people have spent time and energy debating how much money should be the special diet allowance, how many people, you know, what should the eligibility criteria be, how should the figures be set, which medical conditions should qualify for special dietary supplements and which shouldn't. And, you know, there's been an extraordinary amount of energy focused on that by not just the activist community, but by the province itself. But
who are miserably qualified, unfortunately, to make those judgments.
Well, they're clearly not qualified to make the judgments, given what they're doing with the basic allowances.
That's an interesting point.
Now, the most distressing part of this is that this thing that we're talking about, the inadequacy of these basic allowances, has been well documented for years.
Right.
Like, I'm not telling you anything that everybody else doesn't already know.
Yeah.
Every year, in the public health units across this province, public health nutritionists do a costing exercise called the Nutritious Food Basket.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a mandatory program for public health units. So every year they go out and they cost a fixed basket of foods that is, I think it's 62 or something foods, and they're food items that have been very carefully selected to be food items that would together provide an adequate, nutritionally adequate diet,
mm-hmm.
but they are meager, right? They're not luxurious items. They're simple, you know, inexpensive food items that together would comprise a reasonably nutritious diet.
Right.
So since the mid-90s, ironically, this nutritious food basket costing was implemented under the Harris regime.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, annually, we've had public health units doing this costing exercise and publishing the costs of a nutritious diet. When we take those costs and compare them to Ontario Works, it's clear that somebody on OW who is in this single employables category would have to be able to rent an appropriate accommodation for less than $400, and they'd have to be able to meet all of their other needs for nothing,
right.
And then maybe they would have some hope of meeting this nutritious food basket cost.
Yeah.
But it's crazy that as a province, we probably have a better monitoring of the costs of food, of the costs of a low-cost nutritious diet than anywhere else in the country,
mm-hmm.
because it's a mandatory part of public health programming.
Right.
So we've got a very, very elaborate system in place to track these costs. And all that's happened with that tracking is just a tracking of the deterioration of the purchasing power of people on Ontario Works, the
mm-hmm.
increasing inadequacy of their incomes, and the impossibility of even making an intelligent calculation of how much a special diet allowance should be for somebody with extraordinary nutritional needs, given that the base allowance doesn't meet anybody's nutritional needs.
Yeah, that's true. Did you know that veterinary nutrition requirements are legislated anyone who doesn't meet those is in violation of a veterinary act. I can't recall the name of the act, but it's actual act of the legislature. But anyone who feeds their baby KD is free to do so and encouraged to do so by the levels of benefits of the Ontario government. Now, why do we look after our cattle better than we do our kids? I've told this story before. I'll keep telling it until they change their tack in Queen's Park. I met a Liberal campaign worker on the GO train in the first election that elected our present government. And we started talking about support for people on fixed incomes. And he finally grew exasperated in a sort of patronizing way. And he said to me, look, he'd guessed that I was one of them. Because I don't hide it, but I don't disclose it either. He said, what do these guys want anyway? They got enough for a roof over their heads and Kraft dinner. What more do they want? And I thought, wow, I hope when you go home to your roof tonight that you enjoy Kraft dinner too.
Well, but it's so despicable because when we look at the amounts of money that are provided, like I say, this is the most obvious discrepancy is for people classed as single employables. But when you look at those income levels, there's no way that they can be justified. So
Toronto rents with the ODSP levels, there's still no nutritional diet there if you factor in Toronto rents.
Yeah, we've got publicly funded income support programs that can't possibly meet basic costs of living. And yet we've got a government in place that appears to be absolutely unaccountable for those benefit levels. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that is really concerning about this is how little public scrutiny it gets. That, you know, year after year, those of us who work in this area see the publications of the nutritious food basket costing. We do other kinds of research that continue to verify the extraordinary vulnerability of people on welfare in this province. The people who run food banks repeatedly, every single time you see a survey of food bank users, do they tell you? They tell you the majority of food bank users are people on Ontario Works. They also tell you that they cannot meet their needs. You know, every single food drive that ever happens, we hear appeals where they tell us that they're not able to meet their targets. They're struggling to you know...
That their needs have gone up since the last time.
That's right. That's
over
right.
15
so
years.
Demand has risen. They can't possibly meet needs. Any piece of research that we've ever done with food bank users would confirm that. Mm-hmm. People who use food banks in this province are people who need food. They are in desperate need of food. That is something that we've confirmed independently. And we also know that food banks are unable to meet those needs because they simply don't have enough food to go around.
Right.
So you know, from many sources, we've got our medical officers of health across the province every year reporting these nutritious food basket costing figures, comparing them to welfare benefits and clearly demonstrating that those incomes are insufficient to meet basic needs. Mm-hmm. We've got food banks across the province doing these public appeals month after month after month, telling us that they have, you know, demands that they cannot meet. And in the midst of all of that, what have we got? We've got virtual inaction. I mean, a few years ago, the province announced that it had some interest in poverty reduction, which is lovely. And what was their first act? They commissioned some kind of a group to look at the meaning of poverty, to define poverty. They did some consultations that took them to a deprivation index.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the first thing to do was to study the problem, contemplate the meaning of poverty, create some kind of an index to measure it. But, you know, here we sit, 3 years at least since that process was initiated, and whatever increments we've seen to welfare benefits have been trivial, absolutely trivial.
1% this year. And surprise, surprise, we won't hear the results of the poverty study until, wait for it, after the next election in Ontario. I foresaw that. I'm sure a lot of other people foresaw it, but the fact that they went ahead with it, despite the fact that people foresaw it, is what makes it despicable. We knew you were going to pull this on us. We knew you were going to say, "Hi, I'm Dalton McGuinty. I hear you're starving. I have a promise for you if you'll vote for me."
Yeah.
And where have we heard this before?
Yeah. But, you know, what's tragic about this, though, is that I think even if they had revealed their plans prior to the election, you know, I don't know that it would have made any difference. What we've seen, somehow, people don't make the connection between what they're doing in the polls and what happens around these circumstances.
Yeah.
If you think back to the last provincial election, what was the primary issue? The funding of separate schools.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, like, this wasn't even on anybody's radar.
Yeah.
And so, like, there's nothing to...
Nobody called the emperor's new clothes.
No. McGuinty's government has had an absolute cakewalk as it relates to this issue.
Yeah.
And I don't understand that, because we've got a very, very big problem. And we are a population that recognize and, you know, care about food issues. I think that's evident in the tremendous amount of support that food banks get.
Yeah.
It's clear that people don't want to see other people in their communities go hungry. They're prepared to do what they can. They support these huge food drives year after year. You know, these are very well publicized and well respected causes. So there is, I think they speak to a basic social value that Canadians have, which is that we don't think it's appropriate for people in our midst to go hungry. We're prepared to put our hands in our pocket if need be to do what we can. So there is a value there that isn't being respected by our welfare programs, but somehow that nobody makes the connection between that problem and government practices.
Yeah.
And now for our first break of the show, Lucy Kaplansky, Blue Chalk.
So I wonder how she's doing. I hate it when the rumors fly. They give off such a strange sense of mission. When your helplessness on high, she would never run from strangers. She sang along like a bell will toll, way above all the clang and the clutter, out of fear of her demon soul. Far from the mint condition, circulation's higher than you. Hold tight, hang tough, love's not enough to keep you off that stuff, to save you. Hold tight, hang tough, love's not enough to keep you off that stuff, to save. Find the holes in the bottles, even with a blindfold on. Never kept his seat on the wagon, rolling off like a rolling stone. Blue chalk between his fingers, hustling a pool room song. He always kept a line for the singer, pointing his cue right from wrong. Hold tight, hang tough, love's not enough to keep you off that stuff, to save you. Hold tight, hang tough, love's not enough to keep you off that stuff, to save you now. They give all such a strange sense of mission. Wing your helplessness on high. But she would never run from strangers. She sang alone like a bell will toll. Way above all the clang and the clatter. Out of fear of a demon's soul.
A couple of years ago, I don't know what the practice is now, but I bet it hasn't changed. A couple of years ago, I was in one of Burlington's priciest grocery stores, because it happens to be across from one of Burlington's biggest shopping malls. And I live in Hamilton. I go into Burlington from time to time. And I grew up in Burlington when it was a farming town and a farming supply town, and then a bunch of subdivisions built on agricultural land. So I still go back there. And before I leave your store, I said, can I make a donation to your food bank drive? And they said, oh, we only have food bank drives on special occasions. And I looked around for the box for stuff for the food bank, and there wasn't one. And I was really ticked off at this. And I said to the lady, well, that's fine. I only shop in your store on special occasions. And I walked out. But I think part of the problem may lie, and you tell me, neither of us have a lock on the figures for this, but a lot of McGinty's support comes from a very affluent 905 constituency. And I think in that affluent 905 constituency, many people just make the assumption that because the disadvantaged and the disabled are supported, that their needs are adequately met.
Well, I think that's a problem. I'm not sure if it's specific to the 905 areas, but I think that's a problem more generally, that there is an assumption. I think there's an illusion. I shouldn't say an assumption, but I think there's an illusion created sometimes with food charity that like sometimes you'll see slogans that say, you know, donate and help end hunger in your community.
Yeah.
And sadly, donating to these causes doesn't do that. But I think there is some illusion there that probably doesn't help this issue.
Yeah. As far as the linkage between the special diet and the inadequate benefits, both the advocates and the McGinty government have kind of conspired to obscure the codependency of these two awards to disadvantaged people, when in fact, as you've pointed out, the inadequacy of the one spawns the misuse of the other.
I think that's very apt, yeah.
Yeah. So we have an election coming. We won't know after the election what they promise to do, which may be different from what they actually do.
Mm-hmm.
But they're going to propose a replacement for the special diet. I guess what kind of replacement they propose depends on what kind of income they propose.
Well, that's just it. Like, I'm worried about the continued focus on the special diet allowance.
Yeah.
They're proposing a replacement, and of course, what they're going to be looking for is a replacement that diminishes their expenditures on the special diet allowance.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, the system is set for them. You know, everything is structured for that to be the goal here, to cut back on those payments. So I'm assuming we're going to see a leaner and meaner set of eligibility criteria.
Mm-hmm.
But fine. But somebody needs to deal with the basic allowance, because it has an implication for the nutritional well-being of every single person on social assistance in Ontario.
And this is a government that keeps crying about health costs.
Well,
yet,
exactly.
And yet in the meantime, they just keep pushing them up and up and up and into the future, when they will have no control over what health issues come before them, because they were created 10, 15, 20 years ago when they were underfeeding these people.
Right. Well, and everything we know about people on welfare is that they have poor poorer health than people who aren't on welfare.
And life expectancy is 7 to 10 years less.
That's right. So they, and there isn't a single health condition that I can think of that wouldn't be helped by adequate nutrition and that wouldn't be harmed by inadequate nutrition. So, you know, it, whether or not people qualify for, you know, extraordinary needs related to, I don't know, the requirement for Ensure or some particular nutritional supplement product. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, there are conditions that are like that, but mm-hmm. there are many, many other conditions. There are mental health conditions and other sorts of physical health conditions that could be helped if someone had access to a basic healthy diet, you know, consistent, secure access to a basic healthy diet. And that's something that's being undermined by this dickering over the special diet allowance without any serious attention on the part of our government to the base allowance. You know, to make a 1% increase or whatever it is that's been announced now, like, you know, it's just laughable.
Yeah.
As a nutrition researcher, I can tell you that if we were to do a study to look at the impact of those increments on the dietary intakes of people on welfare, we wouldn't be able to see any impact.
No.
Why not? Because the money is so little, it's literally a drop in the bucket.
It's not even a drop
no,
in the bucket.
No, that's right. It'll be invisible.
It's below inflation.
Yeah.
So it's a diminishment of a decrease in the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. For instance, I know it's a tragic situation, but it's one that I think won't stop until we see some integrity mm-hmm. around this issue at the level of government.
Yeah. Well, I hate to say it, that almost mandates that you don't vote conservative or liberal. And I won't say what else you should vote, because this all started back in the NDP government of Bob Rae.
Well, one of the things that I think is fair game here is at this stage, we don't have any political party that, federally or provincially, we don't have any political party that is taking these issues on in the way that they need to be addressed. And so...
So maybe that needs to be, no matter whose rally you show up at, no matter who you support, maybe if you show up, you should be asking these questions of the leader.
I think so. I mean, what people keep telling me is that if politicians are very, very short-sighted creatures, right?
Yeah.
If they thought that the electorate wanted them to respond to this issue, they would do it. I mean, you know, they'll do what they need to.
The state power.
And if they don't think the electorate cares about these issues, then they're not going to. So, but I think we're in a very disturbing situation here where nobody has taken this on, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things that I always think back upon is the election of Mike Harris back in 1995. And that was dramatic, right? You know, that we brought in a conservative government that instantly implemented a 21.6% cut to all welfare incomes, to all, you know, Ontario, we'll rename the program Ontario Works, and cut the benefits by 21.6% across the board, like, instantly.
And in so doing, they added fuel to the fire of their viewpoint that everybody on welfare was a cheat.
I think they
flipped the argument around to the point where the public said, well, if they cut their benefits, they must have been cheating.
Yeah, that's right. But, it the spin around their measures was brilliant, absolutely brilliant, because at the same time that they were making these cuts and setting up snitch lines and invoking all kinds of verification
penalties.
Strategies and things, right? At the same time that they were doing that, we kept seeing stories in the media that I'm sure weren't there by accident, that were stories of welfare fraud, and you know, it was a brilliant campaign.
Oh, CTV even tried to put across in the television a story about disability fraud.
Fortunately,
their advertisers scotched that one.
Well, one thing I have to—I mean, I know this sounds crazy, but one of the things I have to say I respect Mike Harris for is that at least during his campaign for election, he told people that he was going to cut welfare.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Everybody, you know, people should not have voted for somebody who was saying that, but they did.
Yeah.
But he was absolutely frank about what was going to happen. And so when he came in with his, you know, I think it was majority government, wasn't it?
Yep.
And, you know, and then he did what he had said he was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, he did it dramatically, he did it completely. But when I think then to the election of the Liberal government that followed, well, like, they didn't say that.
No, they didn't,
said,
did they?
They said they were going to, they, you
they
know, we had the impression that they were going to address the problems that
inequities
had been created by the
yeah.
Harris government, and that we could expect to see more generous, more adequate social programs.
Yeah.
And instead what happened for many, many years, they carried on the what they called the freeze, right, that welfare incomes were frozen, but that meant they continued to diminish because they're not indexed to inflation.
Yeah.
So, you know, they sat on their hands when they got elected mm-hmm. and watched poor people get poorer,
mm-hmm.
But they talked
and sicker.
As if they talked as if they were compassionate and somehow, you know, addressing these problems.
Yeah,
and
therapists
in some ways, I find that even more disturbing than the blatant, you know, the strident campaign of Harris.
Yeah, therapists have a word for it. They call it passive aggression.
Yes.
Yeah, and you know, a passive aggressive government is the last thing Ontario needs.
One of the tragedies of low incomes, right, and restricted incomes, that people with higher incomes can explore alternative therapies.
Yeah.
They've got the money to try, you know, to purchase more kind of value-added products, more enhanced products, and they get those options.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I can appreciate that health minister's perspective that they can't be using public funds for something that isn't, you know, known to be effective and well proven and accepted by the, you know, medical profession and all that kind of thing, but if I bring the conversation back to food, if you go into a grocery store now, you can find all kinds of products that are touting their nutritional values.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years ago, well, one of the things that over the years people have talked a lot about is trans fats, right?
Mm-hmm.
And trans fats are a particular kind of fat that is found in processed foods, or has been used, found in processed
yeah,
foods.
Yeah, because it keeps better than non-trans fats.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. It enables things to have a longer shelf life and whatever, right? So,
But the scuttlebutt is that every teaspoon of trans fat is equal to 10 teaspoons of ordinary saturated fat.
Well, and I'm not quite sure
effects.
It's a ratio of 1 to 10, but over the years, there's been a lot of research that, and the consensus now is that trans fat is bad for people's health.
Mm-hmm. Let's put it differently, that there is no amount of trans fat that can be deemed acceptable.
That's right. That's
no,
absolutely correct.
No maximum amount, no minimum amount,
that's
no
right.
amount at all.
Yeah. So a few years ago, we did a look at margarines.
Mm-hmm.
And we looked at margarines because margarine is a product that has, depending on which margarine you buy, margarines have been, you know, had been made with hydrogenated fats, which meant that they were high in trans fat. And so a few years ago, we went into grocery stores and looked at margarines and looked at the composition of margarines and their, so the fat composition of margarines and their prices. And what we documented is what I'm sure you can imagine, that as the price of the margarine rose, the healthfulness of it rose.
Mm-hmm.
So products that had no hydrogenated fats, so no trans fats, but you know, unsaturated fats that would be good for health,
mm-hmm.
those were the most expensive products.
Mm-hmm.
The cheapest products in the store were those that were hydrogenated.
Yeah.
And so that was a few years ago.
Levels of hydrogenation have gone down, but the ratio is still true.
That's right.
Maximum level of trans fats you'll find in margarine now are overall, I think, much lower.
Definitely.
Nevertheless, the cheapest margarines
the cheapest
still have margarines more trans
still
fat.
Are hydrogenated margarines.
Mm-hmm.
And so if someone is going to a store with a limited income and they need a source of fat because we use that fat in cooking and we spread
mm-hmm.
it on bread and whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a source of fat is a fairly standard thing in most people's diets.
Mm-hmm.
The cheapest thing they're still able to buy is that hydrogenated fat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, long before we had the Health Canada Task Force on Trans Fat and the recommendations and now the voluntary measures by food industry to lower the trans fat in their products, long before we had all of that, we had some knowledge that trans fat was bad. And higher-income Canadians were able to go to the store and make purchases of margarines and other products that didn't contain trans fat.
Mm-hmm.
But the price differential was substantial. And even today, there's a price differential, right?
Yeah.
Somebody who's on a limited income and is trying to make their money go as far as it possibly can,
mm-hmm.
for them, the hydrogenated fats are still the most economical option.
Yeah.
And you can say, well, it's not economical because they're setting themselves up for heart disease. But, you know,
for them, those are externalities.
That's right. That is a long way off on the horizon.
Well, and they won't pay for it.
Or who knows what will happen by the time they get there. But you know, in the here and now, to hand over, I don't know, 67 cents or 79 cents or 99 cents for a tub of hydrogenated oil, as opposed to $2 or $3 for something that's made with unsaturated fats, you know, it's a no-brainer for most people.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think even, you know, in a very simple example like margarine, or a bigger example like the opportunities to explore alternative therapies for complex conditions, you know, always, always, always we end up in this situation. Even another, to take us off nutrition for a minute, exercise is another part of this story, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Again, you know, people who are physically active, and trying, you know, we've got a concern in Canada right now about the rising prevalence of overweight and obesity.
Yeah.
And part of what we're saying is people need to improve their dietary intakes, but we're also saying people need to increase their physical activity levels.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, again, there are people that are more able to do that than others.
Fitness club, $50 a month.
Oh, minimum. Minimum. Probably,
you know. Go to the why, if you like. Concluding story about the value, about my pet peeve, the value of risking government funds on unproven therapies. A friend of mine came to me and said, I don't know, maybe I should go on ODSP. I hurt all the time. I'm tired all the time. I can't get any kind of support for treating the things that affect me, and I'm not making a lot more than ODSP at my job, but I like working. How can I get more energy? And I said, well, I had the same problem when my disability overcame me. And I can recommend that you start with omega-3 fatty acids and you supplement them with a B-complex vitamins. And that maybe for your mood problems, maybe you take a B12 supplement. Take those three things and let me know how you feel. Well, there was a silence for a few weeks and then come back to me, afraid, I guess, that I would browbeat them, but I told you so. And they came back to me and said, well, you know, it really works. I really do have more energy. But what's evolved is they don't make enough at, you know, $2 above minimum wage to see the value in this kind of ongoing expense.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly someone on a fixed income would be hard-pressed to see the value in this kind of expense unless they'd already taken on the expense and seen the benefits. And this is the problem with, I think, the government ministers. Now, would they rather have someone go on ODSP and get free B12 and free folic acid and a few other items free under their special diet program because they can't afford them when they're working? Or would they rather support these people? We need like a broad-based drug program if they're gonna keep people, you know, baby boomers who are by definition getting older and sicker, if they want to keep them at work where in fact they want to be. It's the same story with home care. It's the same story with employment. They don't want to be in an institution. They don't want to be on a fixed income. They want to be at home, and they want to be going to work every day. But this government seems intent on denying them that dignity.
Mm-hmm.
I can't describe it any other. It sounds horrible. Orwellian. But it's true.
Well, I don't know what to say.
What'll we do?
And now, two-thirds of the way through the show, let's take a break. Lucy Kaplansky. Off and running.
Expect take what's mine.
I think it's really important that people who aren't directly affected by these issues garner some understanding of the problems with these programs. Because I know when I present my work in academic conferences or health professional conferences, there are always people who will say, but that can't be true.
I'm sorry. I like to hear that because it means at least you're reaching a point where they see there's a paradox and then they have to pick sides.
Well, I hope so, but over and over again, I listen to people saying, and often, at the end of my talk, some people will say, are you saying, you surely aren't saying we should just be, throwing more money at this problem.
Oh, I see, throwing more money.
More money at the problem, I know. And then I always think,
You mean, like dimes instead of nickels?
Well, I always say, maybe we could start by just, maintaining the status quo. We've got a situation now where incomes aren't even keeping pace with inflation.
Yeah.
And so, could we just even rectify that problem? Stop taking money away.
Yeah.
But when I hear those lines, I think, oh, my goodness, people are so naive. They assume... They give our government the benefit of the doubt, and they assume that they assume that we've got social programs that are actually just and adequate.
Yeah.
And so it's hard for them to take in the new piece of information that we don't have programs like that. We have programs that, by design, are setting people up to have inadequate food intakes
and health problems.
Yeah, that's right.
In turn, are
compromising their health, and that's by design. If you look at those income levels compared to the nutritious food basket costings, it's painfully obvious that nobody could possibly make it. There can't be any arithmetic that anybody in Queen's Park is doing that looks any different than this. It just simply isn't possible. You can't take a person and give them, an adult, and give them $500 and something a month and expect them to feed, clothe, and shelter themselves.
No.
It's just not going to happen.
No.
And, you strip them of any other asset they have before you allow them access to this benefit.
Before you even allow them to apply for a disability benefit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's not like there's money that can come from anywhere else, because also by design, that's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but somehow we have to share that piece of news with other people, because there are too many people that don't know that story. Like, I keep thinking that if everybody who, you know, through this Christmas season is going out making donations to food banks, to the Red Shield campaign, to, you know, there's so many causes appealing for assistance right now that are, you know, agencies and programs appealing for assistance for programs to help people who are on low incomes. And I'm thinking, if everybody who was compassionate enough to do that understood just how out of whack our publicly funded programs are with basic needs.
Yeah.
I really think, you know, our governments wouldn't be able to keep this up. Like, it only
true,
keeps happening because it's such a big secret.
Take the blinders off, yeah.
Yeah.
The only program I know that really addresses that conundrum in an undeniable way is Do the Math. It's a terrific program. It doesn't seem to get enough publicity, and although it's even spread on the web, I mean, that's its genesis, but it doesn't seem to get enough publicity. I wonder how we can publicize Do the Math.
I think that's an excellent idea for people to go on the internet and type in Do the Math. I think that's, you know, it's a brilliant campaign.
You hear that, listener? Go on the internet, type in Do the Math. Okay, that's your Christmas do-good wish for 2010. And call us back in 2011. We have more we'd like you to do. All right. I appreciate your time with us today. And there don't appear to be any magic solutions on the horizon, except the most magic of all would be persuading one other political party to adopt this as an issue explicitly and a main campaign platform plank. But that would require them to educate their voters as to why they should support this.
They've got some very good tools at their disposal if that's what they choose to do. They've got the Do the Math campaign, and they've got all those Board of Health reports across the province with these nutritious food basket costings in them. So I think the education is actually going to be very simple.
Yeah.
You know, people just simply have to be aware of the arithmetic.
Okay.
So, I agree with you that if we could get someone who's campaigning for election on this next round to actually take this on and talk about it, that would be a huge, huge step forward.
Well, it's a powerful tool. Now that you mention it, when I think of it, you know, your governments have been lying to you. Here's what's happening to your fellow Ontarians, your children who've left home, your parents who are retired, your brothers and sisters who are unemployed. This is what the Ontario government has been doing to them, and they haven't been telling you the truth.
Well, and this is your tax dollars at work.
Yeah, this is your tax dollars at work. My favorite phrase.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. Is this what you want to do with your tax dollars?
Yeah. Is this what you thought they were being used to do?
Yeah. Oh, Valerie, thanks very much for your time today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
All right.
Okay.
Well, we'll get this out on the air on Thursday.
Right. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
And to take us out, Lucy Kaplansky. My name is Joe.
Joe threw another tantrum. He could not be understood. He cries like baby Samson. His English is not good. Joe's boss of the kitchen, but on the outside he knows. Low man on the totem. The good fight. He wears a white uniform. The waiters are all artists out chasing unicorns. Joe works 14 hours. After 10, he starts to booze. He gets very sentimental.
for cover. Maitre D began the list. Drunkard in the corner said his lettuce was not crisp. Former called immigration, said there's someone you should know. He's an illegal alien, and I think his name is Joe. Oh, I know his name is Joe. My name Joe. My name Joe. And he's a king in Thailand. He plays the jazz drum. He has a fine that I got a job to do. Easy questions, easy answers, just point me to the kitchen. He asked Leroy from Harlem, he asked Cisco from Mexico, he asked the white trash from Tennessee. They all said, in my name, Joe, in my name, Joe, in my name, Joe. Maitre D, he sputtered, the kitchen crew, they roared.
Before we go out, a footnote to remember the kind of people these benefits are for. We recorded this about 4 years ago. Maybe you remember it. Butter tarts.
Butter tarts. She is making butter tarts. I lean up against the counter and watch. Impossibly slow, incredibly precise, she fair burns with purpose. I am expected elsewhere to have another meeting about something important, I'm sure, but something bids me watch. As realization dawns, her experience becomes mine. This is what it has all been for. The years of toil and struggle. The captive is freed, and Lady Liberty moves, filling cup after cup. Not a drop of batter spills, or if it does, I don't notice. All I can see is a graceful ballet of movements. Butter tarts. She is making butter tarts. I lean up against the counter and watch. Impossibly slow, incredibly precise, she fair burns with purpose. I am expected elsewhere to have another meeting about something important, I'm sure, but something bids me watch. As realization dawns, her experience becomes mine. This is what it has all been for. The years of toil and struggle. The captive is freed, and Lady Liberty moves, filling cup after cup. Not a drop of batter spills, or if it does, I don't notice. All I can see is a graceful ballet of movements. Butter tarts. Really, butter tarts. She is making butter tarts. Her hands, the ones that mix the batter, are women's hands. I can tell that hers had not been cared for, seldom scented, maybe never even held. Gentleness. She dips the spoon into the batter with such gentleness, as if she wants more than anything never to cause hurt or harm. Her hands, at least, can promise peace. I had worked in one of the places that cage people like her for the crime of difference. I smelled the smells of harsh disinfectant that could never take away the scent of captivity. Her feet still do the institutional shuffle, as if the shackles of that time have disappeared without being loosed. Time slows around us as she turns a mundane chore into a hymn to freedom. Butter tarts. Do you realize the importance of butter tarts? And yes, that she is making them? Sweet batter, unnecessary calories, a smell of luxury all in a frivolous food. Panis Angelicus, not on a diet or menu plan anywhere in the world. Butter tarts. Two words that freeze the heart of every nutritionist. I remember the pinched faces of those who disapproved of any pleasure or warmth for them. I remember locking doors behind me and going home, leaving them there. I remember being watched through cage mesh as I walked to the car. I remember emotional poverty. But now, butter melts. Sugar runs dark with sweet. She is making something rich. Her clothes speak of poverty, her manner of servitude, her posture of meekness. And yet she's making something rich. The thin souls of dietitians shiver. She is baking a revolutionary food, a declaration of independence from those who know better. Butter tarts. With raisins. She is making butter tarts with raisins. There are other people in the room, but none seem to notice her. Sound swirls around her, but cannot penetrate her concentration. Her eyes follow every raisin's fall into the delicate pool of sweetness. Twice she stirs the raisins deep into the batter. Hidden treasures. She smiles in anticipation. I look at the others. Can't they see the glint in her eyes as the raisins fall and she slowly fills each cup? None runs over. They don't need to anymore. Because, and only because, she is making butter tarts with raisins on a pan full and waiting for her. This is her job, not mine. She doesn't need me, my help, my intercession. This is hers. It needs her hands. We are in a kitchen. It has a sink, a fridge, stove. It is like 1,000 kitchens in 1,000 homes. Unremarkable, really, except maybe to her. She would notice the unlocked doors that lead only outside, the windows without mesh or bars, people who know her name and use it kindly. She is here because she wants to be. This is a choice, freely made. Made in freedom. Her hands show no tension from rush, fear, or force. They simply work at their own speed in creation of the sweet hereafter. Butter tarts. I want to call down the corridor of time. Come one, come all, quick, come see. The village idiot is making butter tarts. The institution's moron is scooping batter. The school's imbecile watches the raisins fall. The denied child, her tongue knows sweet. The refused communicant, her heart knows bitter. How long had she waited and endured and prayed for today, the day she would make butter tarts? With the poetry of motion, she is eloquent. She moves in freedom as if its air has the buoyancy of water. In wisdom, we had locked her away for the crime of learning slowly. She will again, I know, be called a retard by those who know better. She will face those who are embarrassed by her presence. She will struggle against bigotry every day to live with dignity. But the battle is won, because now, and all we really have is now, she sits on a comfortable chair and waits for butter tarts.
Tune in at Showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.